Welcome back to another episode of Dance Med Spotlight, where we talk about all things dance medicine and dance science. Today's guest is Jasmine Chalice. She is a freelance registered dietitian and nutritionist based about 40 miles west of London in the UK. She is a specialist working with dancers who has written this fabulous book, Nutrition for Dance and Performance. This is meant for the dance community, roughly the age 18 and over, really approachable information, tons of great information in here as well. I've been enjoying getting some tidbits from this. We talk about her book and more, thinking about tips and tricks for nutrition and hydration on long dance days, keeping up energy, getting through competition weekends, food safety elements, how nutrition links to things like healthy bones and injury recovery, and so much more. Make sure that you check out this episode. We'll also have links to be able to find this book for yourself, because you definitely want to check it out. But listen up for the rest of the episode, and I hope you get some additional tidbits when it comes to nutrition and hydration for dance. Welcome back to another episode of Dance Med Spotlight, where we talk about all things dance medicine and dance science. Today, I have a wonderful guest from the UK, Jasmine Chalice. Welcome, Jasmine.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Jasmine is a freelance registered dietitian and nutritionist based 40 miles west of London, and has written a lovely book as a reference for our dance community. Jasmine, my very first question that I ask guests is, what got you to the point of wanting to work in this way with dancers specifically?
That's a fantastic question. Thank you. It was very serendipitous. When I first started work as a dietitian, I was working in central London, and the doctor there was, one of the doctors, the medics I was working with, was working with an elite ballet school. And they had no nutrition input, and they had a dancer who particularly needed some support. So he asked if I could help, and I helped, and they asked me to do some talks. And then I think my name got passed around a little bit, and sort of over the years, the path has gone there. I mean, he didn't know that I'd always done dance, I don't think, or maybe his subconscious picked it up, that I started when I was, you know, five or whatever, and went till I was about 16. And then as an adult, I'd always done dance classes. So whether he was aware that I had an interest in dance, or whether he just happened to go, hey, this person's new in the department, she looks like she might be interested in dancers, I'll ask her. I don't know. So it was playing to something that I knew something about that world. And then as time went on, and I have two sons now grown up, one of whom themselves both did dance, but one actually trained and worked as a dancer for some time. So I did the whole, you know, eating in the car, how are you going to get the food in scenario. So it was translating theory into practice. And I was aware for a long time about the lack of a book. Yes. And the trouble, of course, with dance in every country and sports, nutrition, but dance nutrition is worse, is the lack of money to pay enough registered dietitians and qualified dance nutritionists to be able to provide the support that dancers really need.
And I think that's one of the biggest things across the board for the dance community, is it's just not, it's not like other sport where it may be a much larger money generator, where they have the extra funds to pay for nutrition and dietitians, physical therapists, whomever, to be a regular part of the community and supporting everybody. It's an unfortunate thing for sure.
Yeah, it was interesting. I was at the International Sport and Exercise Nutrition Conference from Monday to Wednesday this week in rainy Manchester. And that, again, that attracts lecturers and speakers from all over the world. And mm-hmm. when they were talking about elite football, that they don't think it's enough to have one nutritionist full time for 100 performers. And I was thinking, what do I even say to that? I'm speechless. The idea of actually having one full time nutritionist to 100 dancers every word would just be amazing, wouldn't it? I think a few places right. probably do have that. But mm-hmm. I think they're going to be very few and far between. You actually have full time.
Yes.
100 performers.
Yes. That would be phenomenal to have widespread. So tell us a little bit about the book that you've written. And let's start maybe with intended audience and what you're hoping to share with them.
Yeah. So it's written for age 18 upwards. Not that it wouldn't be useful for the 16 to 18 year olds, but there wasn't enough space in the 100,000 word max to be able to look in depth at adolescence, although there is a little bit of a reference to growth in there because not everybody's finished growing by the age of 18. Mm-hmm. So it's aimed at vocational dance students and dance undergrads, so those who are studying dance as a large part of their studies from 18, professional dancers and dance teachers. Mm-hmm. So it's aiming to provide useful information to as wide an audience as I could make it.
Mm-hmm. One of the things, and it's at the very beginning of the book, very first chapter, one thing that I liked in here is this statement. For the dancer as a performing artist, artistry and expression are primary goals, but unless they're physiologically honed to the same extent that they are artistically, their physical conditioning may potentially be the limiting factor in their development and performance. I think that's such an important statement because we do so much to support that technical side, the performance side, but don't yet appreciate, again, like we do maybe in some other sport, how much physically training, psychologically supporting ourselves through nutrition and hydration, how much that really plays into the dancer being able to do their craft as successfully as possible.
Yeah. And in fact, actually what I should have meant was it is also aimed at dance scientists, those who aren't nutrition specialists, and dance physios, strength and conditioning coaches, etc., who can access the information. Because yes, it is actually making sure that the dancer is as fit and strong as they need to be, and they have the support for recovery from injury from all aspects, from mm-hmm. all of the professionals who work together. And as was put at the conference this week, without nutrition, there really isn't going to be any performance.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. One of the things that comes up a lot in my practice, I work a lot with adolescent competitive dancers, is the idea of the way their schedule is, being able to fuel adequately, whether it's their dance schedule is such that they're dancing 5 hours in a row with only time to change shoes and things between classes. So how are they going to eat? Or some of these crazy weekends when they're doing competitions and conventions and have things booked for hours throughout the day, mm-hmm. finding opportunities to support their bodies from that nutritional standpoint. What are some recommendations that you maybe have for dancers like that?
I think if we look at the schedule one first, it's probably easier to do the two separately. Mm-hmm. And schedules can vary so much. And I think sometimes dancers can have almost too much time. And then to actually use that productively is also a challenge because it's, oh, okay, what do we do when we've got lots and lots of time? And could that be used not just to sit and eat, which of course is incredibly important, but to mm-hmm. think about planning other meals and snacks for times when the schedule is absolutely flat out. I think depending on the age of the dancer, and this is going to be a little bit heretical, but I think we have to go there. And I think a new generation of teachers are hopefully not putting those back-to-back classes such that you can't even grab a snack and go to the bathroom as well as change your shoes. Mm-hmm. You need to be able to keep hydrated through the classes as best as you can, but fill up your water bottle in the gap, mm-hmm. get a snack or parts of a meal in. If you're doing 5 hours, that's a lot of fuel you're going to need.
Yes.
And if not, you're going to start flagging, and then the teachers are going to be going, why aren't you performing? Well, you're not performing because you don't have the energy. Mm-hmm. And adrenaline will take you so far, but it won't take you endlessly.
Yes.
So I think if it's an adolescent group, if it's a slightly younger group where there's parental involvement, I think it would be great if parents can work together and actually speak to the teachers and say, do you realize that there is this group who are going from this to this to this, and they haven't got time to breathe? And actually, guys, as teachers, are you looking after yourselves? Mm-hmm. You know, have you got time to drink enough and go to the bathroom and have a snack? Because everybody is going to work better if actually their blood glucose level is in a fairly stable state. Mm-hmm. And their energy is staying up. Now, I'm not suggesting you need time to go and eat a full roast dinner. I'm not suggesting that by any stretch of the imagination. But think about that schedule. Can it be changed? How do you manage it? Mm-hmm. If we're looking at people who are in full-time training from either 16 or 18, then often it's a 15-minute break and you have to be very skilled. You need to make, it's planning. So much of nutrition is actually planning.
Yeah.
What have you got with you? Have you got with you what you need? And always assume that the schedule will run late and your break will be a few minutes shorter than you think it was going to be.
Yes.
Snacks which are energy dense, so dried fruit with a few nuts mixed in for a bit of protein, things like banana bread. So the low fat, high carb protein isn't going to be so much of an issue in the short term, but you don't necessarily want to be living on just candy, sweets either. Mm-hmm. That will give you enough of a hit to get through the next 20, 30 minutes, but then you're going to have to repeat that. And your body probably isn't feeling great if you've had a large proportion of your intake for the day as candy.
Mm-hmm.
So planning, thinking about, have you got some plain sandwiches with you? You know, if they've got some honey or some jam in them, or maybe some peanut butter, those are easy. They're not going to go bad because food safety.
Mm-hmm.
Food safety is another issue. So for the schedule, it's looking at the schedule, preparing as best you can for it, being prepared to improvise, always having an extra bar with you, some extra dried fruit with you. Maybe some sports drinks. We can talk about fluids in a minute, but thinking about what fluid is going to work, possibly more than just water if you've got a long, demanding schedule.
Yes.
Have you got more than you think you need? And that's the day-to-day schedule. And hopefully it won't be 5 hours back-to-back every single time.
Yes.
And I think it's also dancers learn to eat when they're not hungry, because when they are hungry, they are going to be in the middle of a class.
Mm-hmm.
So that it is still intuitive eating. It is still giving your body what it's asking for, but it's being able to get the nutrition in at the time and opportunity that you've got.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the schedule bit.
Yes. And before we go on to sort of these long weekends, long days, like competitions or maybe big show days, I want to go back to something that you mentioned, talking about the parents. If we're working with dancers that do have parents involved at any level, I think sometimes we don't appreciate what a resource and ally we have with the parents, where exactly to your point, if several of them come together and talk to the teacher, the studio owner, director, whomever is in charge of something, and say, hey, we have a concern, we've been noticing this, what can we do to help? There's so much power in that. and being able to provide the education and resources to the parents to then empower them to be able to take those steps, I think that's where we have the potential for a lot of change.
I think so, yes. And I think parents together can come up with very polite but constructive suggestions, because often when we're under pressure and trying to run a, you know, do anything that's demanding, you don't necessarily see an alternative. If you're super creative, mm-hmm. and some people may, you know, maybe have absolutely solved things, but sometimes getting a few brains together can give a different view and find a way to solve a tricky problem. I mean, it's never going to solve the problem of these dancers need to do this number of classes. but is there a way to split the groups up? Is there a way to give part of a group a break differently so it doesn't flow? I know, for example, teachers would always like to have a group in, do their two or three classes and then they go. But maybe actually they will do better if there's a short different class for a different group for half an hour, 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. So although the dancers are there for a bit longer, they've actually had a bit of a break and a chance to refuel.
Yes.
I'm not a studio owner. I'm not a dance teacher. I have seen dance teacher schedules and witnessed them and had that with my own children. So, you know, I know what it can be like. And I think there is a wish to make it easiest for the parents so that the kids can get home as quickly as possible. But actually asking the parents maybe if there's something slightly different that could equally work is a brilliant idea. Mm-hmm. And raising concerns. But I think raising concerns and having a suggestion is yes. even better than raising a concern.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So let's go back to this idea of when we have those perhaps longer days or weekends, maybe it's when all of the shows are that they're performing, maybe it's the competition convention weekend. Are there maybe different strategies dancers can use in those sorts of situations versus just longer chunks during normal training during the week?
I think, again, planning is the crucial one, because one of the things about competitions and conventions is that you're away from home. Mm-hmm. So firstly, it's planning for the travel, whether it's by plane, by car, whatever the means of transport is, that the journey is a chance to take nutrition on board. So making sure that's planned for, knowing that if you're staying away, which it will be if it's a weekend, almost certainly for most people, mm-hmm. where are the food outlets? What's available on site? Is it going to be adequate? If not, what are you going to take with you? Or where is the nearest grocery store? Where is the nearest, what are the options for deliveries in terms of takeaway meals? Looking at reviews for that. So that's research for the dancer. Mm-hmm. What is going to work for me? And particularly if somebody's got special dietary requirements, they're going to need to plan for that even more carefully, because the range of what they're going to be able to access easily is likely to be more limited. Mm-hmm. So the planning before you even arrive is incredibly important. And then again, dance competitions don't necessarily run to schedule. I believe there are some yes. which are to the minute. I believe there are some where literally it's timetabled and it will run to schedule. But there's a lot more where it just doesn't. So dancers find themselves not really knowing when they can eat. And that's where the sort of the packed lunch that's got lots of different things. So it's got some chopped up fruit. It's got some chopped up raw veggies. So peppers, carrots, tomatoes, cherry tomatoes. It's got some protein, whether that's some chicken, whether it's some corn, whether it's some lower fat cheese. Something that's not going to be too bulky, and then some carbohydrates, whether it's crackers, bread, couscous, quinoa, rice, a noodle salad, a cold pasta salad. Familiar things. Remember, never try anything in a competition that you haven't practiced before.
Yes.
That's a really big one. So you need, you know, if you're going to be away from home, how do you access those foods that you know work for you? And also actually that you've practiced the foods that will be available in your dance schedule before that. So you do it both ways. And maybe thinking a little bit about fluids, particularly if it's a hot environment.
Yes.
Keeping up with fluids is so, so important. And whilst water is going to be the safest drink, and particularly for younger dancers, there's really not much work being done using, say, electrolytes. Sports drinks are a little bit more tested. Dentists won't love you for using them too often, that's for sure. But water, if your schedule isn't too demanding, but as people's workload increases, then that's when looking at whether an isotonic sports drink, there are recipes in the book, there are recipes on the web, and you can buy commercial sports drinks. And it's going to be different things that are going to work under different circumstances. So those, or using electrolyte supplements, particularly in really hot and high environments where dehydration. So if you're kind of heading to any of the higher states, Colorado, I guess, would be one that comes to mind.
Yes.
But you're mindful of the effects of that drier, thinner air, and the fact that you're likely to be losing more fluid. I mean, the upside is, if it's not so humid, you can sweat more effectively. I just had images of a sort of New York summer's day and thinking that's the opposite. You know, the air is so saturated there that actually sweating effectively is difficult. So you might have more fluid lost just by sweat dripping off you. But thinking, and just one other thing while I think about it, you know, water bottle size, so important. Pitching up, I should have brought it with me. I've got one in the other room, a tiny, you know, tiny little few ounce bottle, a couple of hundred mils. Not very practical. Unless that's going to be literally side of stage. There may be an occasion where it's useful to have different sizes with you. But that's another thing, that if you haven't got the right size, you can't put enough fluid to last you a decent length of time.
Yeah, if you're going to be in class for 2 hours and you take a little bottle like this, not going to work well. I think the thing that really jumps into my brain with all of that, there's two things. So one, yes, definitely when it's altitude and drier air and that sort of thing, I'm in Colorado and have worked events where we've actually had kids come in from other altitudes, lower altitudes, and they weren't keeping up on water. They were dancing a lot, sweating a lot, not eating well, hardly eating breakfast before they start dancing, and starting to suffer from altitude sickness and significant dehydration, to the point where one kiddo I actually had to send to the emergency room to get hydrated because she was so sick on site. And it had been hours of dancing and she had had, you know, maybe this much water. So such an important thing. The other piece that jumps out to me is, as a person who still dances, still competes, and does have some dietary, more specific dietary needs, one habit I've gotten into is checking the hotel that I'm staying at. Do they have refrigerators available in the rooms? Do they have microwaves available? Because I've taken things before and then it turns out my room doesn't have something, or, you know, before I figured out the whole planning piece, or I was banking on being able to get something at their restaurant, but they had a modified menu for when the competition was there to make it easier on the kitchen. So I didn't have some of the options I was thinking about. And so In my dance bag, I carry an extra protein bar that also has some fruit and things mixed in it, maybe some beef jerky. I have a variety of little snacks that I keep in that bag just so I can nibble on things as I need, and then figure out what for when I do have longer periods of time where I can buy something or order something or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
That has been so important.
Yeah, I think that list of things which can be kept at an ambient temperature and or making sure you've got a cool bag, and, you know, a smallish one works fine, that you can actually either get the small freezer packs, ice packs, so that that will keep the food cold. Or one trick I actually learned in the US was getting some of the drinks that it is actually safe to freeze. So you freeze them. They act as a nice block in your cool bag, and then you've got an extra drink as well. Mm-hmm. So that can be quite a useful strategy, but definitely, yes, checking that the menu hasn't been altered is definitely going to be an important thing. And there was something else that crossed my mind about fluid, but I can't remember. Oh, I think it was just to say that with regard to our sensitivity, if we lose about 2% of our body weight by dehydration, that's the level where our physical ability to work, for the majority of people, it's that level and above that starts to impact. So if you have a smaller, lighter weight dancer, it's not going to take much for them to be in a place where they're really going to be struggling. So I think it's good for teachers to really, if they're sending dancers or taking dancers to conventions and competitions, to really themselves check about the climate, and check out what's available. And I think the ideal is if you can be in a hotel, which is one of those that's got like a mini kitchen, so that you can arrive with a refrigerator load of stuff and you can pack your own sandwiches. You can, if you've got a long enough break, go back and heat a meal up. And it may even be that if there's one that's relatively close by, that it's, even if it's a bit more expensive, if you're going to save on meals overall, that actually it's worth doing.
Mm-hmm. One thing I've gotten in the habit of as well is, say I do order delivery from someplace for a meal. If it's someplace where I know they have foods that work for me and I have access to a fridge, I'll order multiple meals worth and just keep them in the fridge so I don't have to worry later in case the schedule doesn't run on time, in case something pops up where I want to go do something with friends that are there. I don't have to worry about finding food because I know I have some in my room that I can access. And one thing I actually found through Amazon that has been a nice little addition, it looks like a small lunch box that you can plug in and it has a hot plate in it. Mm-hmm. And so you can have, you know, a little glass dish or whatever it is that you have, set it in there and it slowly warms up the food. So sometimes even for breakfast, I'll put potatoes and different things that I've prepared for my breakfast, just maybe a scramble, set it in there as I'm starting to get ready for the day. And then in about 15, 20 minutes, it's nice and toasty warm and I can enjoy my breakfast in the room if I don't have a microwave. And so that has been something that I sometimes pack along to make life easier also.
Yeah, that I haven't actually even tried yet. That sounds excellent. I think just from a food safety point of view, it's really important to remember that cold food needs to be kept sort of 4 degrees or below. Hot food needs to be kept properly hot. That's 4 degrees Celsius. Can't quite do it in Fahrenheit this afternoon. but people get the concept, keep cold food cold, keep hot food hot. And if you've had something delivered hot, really think very hard about whether it's safe to reheat it again. And how long you keep it for. Normally, the recommendations are from a food safety point of view. If something's been kept hot for more than a couple of hours, it needs to go after that point. Obviously, you can keep things cold for a lot longer than that. But really, being safe with food, being careful with food safety. Definitely. Because nobody wants food poisoning on the back of the back of everything else.
No, that's never a good thing. One thing also that I think is important to think about and talk about for dancers is this idea of having energy for the activities that they do. Sometimes I find all too often, no matter what level of dancer, age of dancer, their go-to if they feel like, oh, I know I have a longer day, or it's later in the evening and I need to keep going with my rehearsals, I'm going to get coffee. I'm going to drink an energy drink. I'm going to, you know, something where I am relying on caffeine to provide energy versus perhaps the way that I'm eating and fueling through food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Any particular thoughts on that idea?
Oh, I think we have a few thoughts about caffeine.
You might.
I mean, caffeine actually for adults, so 18 pluses, can be a really useful performance enhancer, but it can't work in isolation. And actually, I think a lot of people learnt over their lives, if you just have too much caffeine, you don't get energized, you just get kind of irritable and unsettled, really, and you can't focus because you've just had too much caffeine. There is a lack of data and a lack of safety data in caffeine for children. And there are definitely recommendations that it should only be small amounts. So if you're still growing, check out the recommendations, check out the research, and really be careful how much caffeine you have. Caffeine in drinks, it used to be, or if you're drinking coffee or tea, it's going to dehydrate you. That was a view that was around a lot of years ago. Mm-hmm. If you're used to the caffeine and it's not, it's a normal amount, say a single shot of coffee or a regular cup of tea, it's not, it can count as part of your fluid. If you're looking at huge coffees from commercial outlets, or they've got two or three shots or more, mm-hmm. then that can have an impact on whether the fluid stays in you for long enough or not. Not necessarily dehydration, like taking out more fluid, but speeding it through. So there is a hydration aspect. From an alertness point of view, yes, a small amount of caffeine can be useful. But it's also important to remember that the half-life of caffeine is between about 5 and 8 hours. Now, those who've done chemistry recently will probably remember what the half-life is. So the half-life is how long it takes to break down half of whatever the chemical, in this case, caffeine, is. So if you have a cup of coffee, between 5 and 8 hours later, you will have half of that caffeine left. Mm-hmm. To get rid of the next half of that half, so the next quarter, takes another 5 to 8 hours. So if you're constantly topping up your coffee levels, then the caffeine levels are going up and up. And there's a point where there is no more benefit. And actually it moves into, as I've just mentioned, the irritability side of things. Mm-hmm. So it does help performance. It does seem to help endurance a bit, definitely. But it needs to go with fuel. Mm-hmm. And one of the issues that can happen is that the dose of caffeine and the dose of sugar, if it's an energy drink, is going to give a quick hit. But it's much more likely that for the majority of people, that is going to then wear off. And they're going to be wired, but the sugar level has dropped down, which is really not where you want to be. Mm-hmm. So if you're at the side of the stage, or if you're in the dressing room, you've got half an hour, you haven't had time to eat very much, eating a bowl of porridge at that point isn't going to be useful. Mm-hmm. A small sandwich or a bar and a bit of an energy drink or a coffee or a tea, a small amount, could be useful. The problem if it's a very sugary drink is that you're going to have that liquid sitting in your stomach for longer because it's more slowly absorbed than a sports drink.
Mm-hmm.
So you might end up actually finding that you drink the energy drink because you were feeling so awful and you were dehydrated. So you thought, I'll do two things at once. And then you go on stage half an hour later or into class half an hour later and the sugar's being absorbed, but a lot of the liquid is still there. And I think most dancers know that sensation where you take off and your stomach takes off with a liquid in it and you land and then the liquid lands. It's not great for feeling good. And it's not going to have you feeling like you're most comfortable to perform at your best or to train at your best.
Mm-hmm.
So caffeine is to be used judiciously. 3 or 4 coffees or teas a day max, and that's with single shots, is likely to be useful. If you're not used to caffeine, please don't take it for the first time in a competition situation, because you don't know. Some people are very caffeine sensitive and just find that they react in an unbearable, it just is not good for their nervous system. Some people are really very caffeine tolerant, and actually they can keep putting the caffeine in until they're actually at the jittery stage. So, and there's a big spectrum in between. So I think it's knowing your own body, thinking about fueling with the more slowly digested carbs, which are going to keep your blood sugar level more steady. And actually, if you put a bit of protein in with carbs, that slows things down. Sure, if you put a lot of fats in, it will slow things down, but that's not going to feel great. Eating a load of fries with something in batter is going to take a long time to digest. So that's not ideal when you're in a high pressure situation. Doesn't mean you can't ever eat those foods. All foods are there to be enjoyed. It's about the frequency and the timing and the amount. So it's thinking, it's part of it is the practicing. How does caffeine work for me? If you're going to drink a large can of an energy drink, it might well be the amount of caffeine for the day that's recommended. And it's probably more than you're ever going to get performance enhancement from. So do your research. Check out the data. The book's got information on caffeine. And you know, I try to put in there what I would want to find. Look, if you're an undergrad, postgrad, dance student, professional, teacher, look at the research that's been done. What's been done, I would like to say, in the different form of dance, but I think in any form of dance, or if not in team sports. People might be thinking, well, why team sports? Well, dance is closest to a team sport than it is, say, distance running, because you don't go on stage and keep the same level of energy. Nor is it a 100-meter sprint, very rarely. It's more like that intermittent sprint. You start, you stop, you do something, higher intensity, lower intensity. So look at the research that's there. And this applies not just to caffeine, but to any nutrient, to see what the latest research is, because research does change slowly. It rarely changes super fast.
Thinking about the caffeine piece, I know that's something that I've figured out for myself. I just recently, you know, in the last couple of years, started drinking coffee, finally got a taste for it and enjoyed it and that sort of thing. And then it became, ooh, this is good. I'm just going to drink it. But also as somebody with anxiety and things like that, I quickly learned what it feels like to get over caffeinated. And so I've learned, you know, days where maybe I wake up and I'm already feeling kind of that nervous system buzz where this isn't a calm day necessarily how I'm starting out. Maybe I shouldn't have coffee this morning, or, you know, and kind of figuring out that balance, knowing what my body feels like, knowing how it responds to different things like that. That was an interesting lesson to figure out.
Yeah. And you can always use decaf, and you can always actually mix caf and decaf if you just want to get a small amount of the caffeine. If you're making it yourself, I think that's where you're in charge. The trouble is, if you're buying the coffee, A, it's expensive, and a lot of dancers actually are on limited budgets. And I would say if you can find a way to provide your own coffee and use that money towards more fruit, more veg, more protein, because finance is often the challenge, and be in charge of what milk you use, how much calcium's in that milk if you're not using dairy, and how much caffeine you're having, it's a win-win at every level. It takes a bit more effort. That's the downside. You've got to put a bit more thought and energy into it. But actually, I think making it can also be quite a relaxing activity.
Yeah, having a little ritual for yourself of how you prepare your meals and pack your bag to take with you for the day or for the competition weekend. I kind of enjoy that, getting it all together.
Yeah, it's part of the preparation. It is part of the ritual of what sets you up and tells your, you know, that's the psychology bit, isn't it? Or moving into that of what sets the scene for, hey, I'm going to a competition. This is what I do.
And we know dancers love their rituals and routines for things. So it's just one more way to be able to incorporate that. Thinking about another topic we haven't really talked about yet is the idea of nutrition as it relates to things like healthy bones and injury recovery. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, there's so much to pack in there. I think we'll just touch the surface a little bit here, because
yes, and then we'll refer them to the book.
Yeah, and you know, there will be other books that are going to be around coming out, sort of on dancers and injury risk reduction. That's certainly is, I know that's coming through the pipeline, and there's research as well in certainly from the bone health. There are so many nutrients involved in healthy bones. So calcium is the one that everybody thinks about. And yes, it's incredibly important. And vitamin D is incredibly important, because you need enough vitamin D in your body to be able to absorb calcium. And so those are really crucial. So healthy bones need calcium. They need vitamin D. But they also need vitamin K. They also need protein. They also need vitamin C. They also need other minerals. So there are a number of nutrients around the healthy bones intake. Weight-bearing exercise is important for healthy bones. Now, that's a given for dancers, that box. But also really important is not being underfueled, because if dancers are underfueled, one of the ways that is can be identified is when hormone levels aren't normal. So for female dancers who are not on the oral contraceptive pill, that they would maybe have irregular periods or lighter periods or no periods. That's a risk factor for bone health. And for male dancers, it's a little bit harder to tell, but being underfueled or being too lean for either male or female dancers is a risk factor for low hormone levels, and that's a risk factor for bone health.
And I think that's something that we don't necessarily realize for dancers, and supporting with the nutrition. Like you said, we think about calcium, vitamin D. Dancers, if we're spending a lot of time in a studio, we're probably not getting as much sunlight to try to get some of that vitamin D. So making sure that we're getting that supplementation through our food and whatnot too. And thinking injury recovery stuff, I know when our body is healing, kind of the way I explain to my dancers, our body has a certain amount of energy that it is capable of holding for the day. You're using that just for breathing and functioning as a human, even if you were just going to lay on the floor all day. You need some of that for whatever activities that you're doing. But if you're dealing with some sort of injury, healing tissue, some of that energy gets diverted towards that as well. And so we need to make sure that we're providing enough energy in whatever sense that is, to support all of those things that our body needs to be able to do.
Actually, there was a really good session on, it was a sort of injury nutrition, which was just nice to hear that everything is still just kind of in this moving along. There's more research needed, but that actually there might be higher requirements for something like protein. And although you may not be dancing as much and using up some energy there, that actually if you're on crutches, getting around on crutches is really quite, it's more energy demanding than walking. And often dancers are doing a rehab program, which is quite energy demanding as well.
So
although they may not be dancing, and quite often dancers will think, hey, I'm not dancing, I don't need to focus quite as much on my nutrition. Maybe I should cut down, maybe I shouldn't be eating as much. Try and listen to your body, because actually it is a really good guide to what you need, as long as you have listened to it. If you've overridden it for a long time, that's I would suggest getting specialist support one-to-one with an experienced dance dietitian who also is familiar with the issues of underfueling and disordered eating and eating disorders, because that can get a bit complicated. Mm-hmm. But certainly thinking about all of the nutrients required. And if you've got something where you've had surgery and you've lost blood, maybe you need to replace those red blood cells. That's going to need different nutrients. If you've had bruises, again, new red blood cells needed. So is it bone? Is it tendons, ligaments, muscles, or skin? Or is it red cells? You know, what is it that's got to repair? Do your research and think about what your body needs. Because when you're injured, you can't control a lot of what happens. You can't make the recovery rate faster than its maximum, but if your nutrition isn't good, you can sure slow down that recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And I think vitamin D likely has links with recovery from injury as well. And certainly through the winter, in a lot of latitudes, the sun just isn't strong enough to make vitamin D. So through the summer months, getting outside for 15 minutes and being able to synthesize some vitamin D is a great plan.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, much of the year, it probably is going to need a supplement. Check out what the local requirements, local recommendations are. And some dancers would be advised to take vitamin D all the year round. There's still some uncertainty about what forms of vitamin D we're measuring, and is the deficiency as clear as it seems? But I think that the research with dancers is there's a link between their vitamin D levels and their recovery from injury, and therefore it makes sense to address vitamin D and to try mm-hmm. and get some sunlight, which is of course also great for our brains anyway. Not burning, not taking that risk, 10 to 15 minutes a day. Sunblock is going to stop vitamin D creation. As far as I'm aware, so far, up to about factor 25, you can still make some vitamin D. But thinking about vitamin D as a particular topic, because it's multi roles within the body, and we're still just learning about that.
Mm-hmm.
So injury and recovery and bone health, they overlap. And if you're immobilized, then thinking about your bone health as well, because you're not weight bearing for a while. So making sure that, oh, well, actually the injury I've got, I've had surgery on, what can I think of? An ACL, say a mm-hmm. ligament. Mm-hmm. But you're going to be not weight bearing as much. So don't be just thinking about the protein. Think also your bones still needs attention for the calcium and so on.
Mm-hmm. And I think all of that just really highlights the importance of finding the right people to work with if you are dealing with some sort of injury, surgery, whatever. Because, you know, I think sometimes, whether it's due to finances, due to who knows what all, we may choose to, I can handle this myself. I can look up a couple things on the internet. I've got this. But even having a few sessions with somebody who can help guide you through some of this, provide some information of maybe how to tailor things more specifically to you. And I know there's research out there. I just saw something shared the other day that I want to go back and dive into, where things as simple as an ankle sprain, which what dancers haven't had an ankle sprain at least once in their lives, probably, not receiving care for it has a whole slew of other things that happen down the line that kind of fester in there a little bit. And so it's like, just go see somebody, even if it's once, and get some information and guidance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's where all of the profession, the healthcare professions and the support team work together. And we all, I'm sure for yourself, you know, if somebody has got very limited insurance cover, or if somebody's budget is really limited, then we will do our best. One session is definitely better than nothing. One mm-hmm. and a follow-up is much better still, because we can check what you understood, but yes. At least getting some help from somebody that can keep that bigger picture, by whatever means. And healthcare systems vary, and I know access to healthcare is very varied, but I think it is worth that investment because I'm the nutritionist saying that for the dancer, their instrument is their body. Mm-hmm. As a performer, that's where they're at.
Right. Exactly. Well, I think at this point, this is perfect timing for a special segment that we have on the show. So we have the final bow. This is essentially the take-home message for the audience. We've talked about a lot of different things, many different topics. What is maybe one thing that you want the audience to leave with, if nothing else?
I think it has to be the importance of planning to get nutrition requirements, get your body's nutrition requirements in, because there are so many challenges. Planning as best as you can so that you know what you're aiming to get in and how you're aiming to do it. I think improvising for dancers with nutrition, sure, when you've got lots of time and you haven't got a schedule, it's great to do. But when you've got a busy schedule, when you've got competitions, you plan for every other element of it, plan for the nutrition.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Last and certainly not least, the shameless plug. This is your opportunity to promote anything that you have going on, anything that you would like. So have at it.
It's got to be get yourselves a copy of 300 pages of Nutrition for Dance and Performance. There's just so much useful information in there. I do pop up on Instagram. I do appear sometimes on X when I've been to conferences with little snippets and so on. But I think that's where I've put so many hours over the last couple of years. It only came out in June. So actually using that as the best resource. And other than that, yeah, I think that's probably the main one.
Mm-hmm. One thing I want to point out about this book also, since I've had a chance to read through, is I really like, there's the table of contents in the front that gives you kind of the general topics, but then within each chapter, we'll see if this comes across, there's a list of other things that are covered within that. So there's a lot of detail in here. It's written in a really approachable way for people to understand who don't, this is not meant for dietitians already. This is for people to be able to pick up and read and get some really helpful information from, and organized in a really helpful way. And so whether you're a dancer, dance teacher, studio owner, artistic director, dance parent, whomever, or professionals working with dancers wanting some more information to help, go get this.
Thank you. Yes. It's the book that I would recommend even if I hadn't written it, because it's got the information in that dancers need, as much of it as could be fitted in.
Mm-hmm. And it's definitely something that I've added to my resource list for dancers when we're seeing that they're needing some support with this.
Fantastic. Brilliant. Thank you.
Well, Jasmine, thank you so much for your time today. I've really enjoyed our conversation together, and I'm looking forward to seeing how the information in this book and other things that you share continues to help the dance community.
Brilliant. Thank you for inviting me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Dance Med Spotlight is hosted and produced by Alyssa Arms. We discuss all things dance medicine. This has been another episode from Dance Med Spotlight. The Dance Med Spotlight is intended for educational purposes only. No clinical decision-making should be based solely on one source. While care is taken to ensure accuracy, factual errors can be present.